Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Martha Barnett has spent two decades as co-host of Away With Words, lauded by Mary Norris in The New Yorker as a virtual treasure house and car talk for lexophiles. Over the time, she's developed a keen sense of what fascinates people about language. They're curious about etymology, revel in slang, they're surprised by regional vocabulary and celebrate linguistic diversity. Idioms both puzzle and delight word lovers, and they're eager to share family neologisms and that weird phrase that Grandma always used to say. In her book, Friends with Words, Barnett weaves together all these strands in an entertaining exploration of language. And Friends with Words also tells Barnett's story from her Appalachian roots through her study of ancient Greek and on to the making of a beloved and enduring show. So, Martha Barnett, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here, Tom.
Of course, public radio listeners hear your program all over the country every week. Great to have this book, your fourth book, I think.
Fourth book on word origins.
On word origins. Okay. Yeah. Other books as well. So I want to start with your story, including very timely in these times. Your show got canceled by your local public radio station. You had to launch your show. We'll get to that. But where did you grow up?
I grew up in Kentucky. My father was a professor at the Baptist Seminary in Louisville there, and my parents met there. She was his student, actually. And so I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. They both had Southern roots. He was born in a log cabin in Appalachia, so I have a lot of that in my background as well. But I grew up in Kentucky, went to college in New York, which was kind of linguistic culture shock, you know, because I had used words all my life in Kentucky that I thought people would understand there, and sometimes they didn't.
Give me an example or two, and we all have this, I think. You know, you grew up in a family, you have words, maybe just developed because baby couldn't say that word or whatever, grandma had that weird phrase, right? And then you go somewhere else and find, oh, no. So give me an example or two.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of conversation that we quite often have on Away With Words, and I call them two-headed conversations. A listener will call the show and say, you know, I grew up in Texas, and I moved across the country, and I used this expression, and people looked at me like I had two heads. Mm-hmm. And I understand what they mean, because, of course, we have all these different regional dialects in the United States, and I had that experience as well. When I was in Kentucky, I grew up saying the word tump. Do you know the word tump?
I do not know the word tump, no.
T-U-M-P. This is, you know, as common to me as you know, dog or cat. Don't tump over the canoe. Don't tump over your... Actually, I tumped over my water just before we sat down, so I had to wipe it up. But yeah, tump. And then I went to school in upstate New York, and early on when I was there, I said to somebody, don't tump over your glass. And they just looked at me like I had two heads, because tump is a Southernism. And if you have listeners who grew up in the South, they're going to know what I'm talking about. But a lot of the rest of the country has never heard this word. And to me, that's one of the real delights of language. You mentioned the diversity of American English. You know, you go to different parts of the country and you hear people talking different ways. And to me, that's an opportunity to be curious about where that word came from and who uses it.
Were you always interested in language and words?
Yes, I was always interested in words. I mean, I sort of couldn't help it, because my mother was an English teacher. She taught in the public schools for 25 years, and had really delightful ways of teaching English. She had a lot of tricks and gimmicks that made grammar interesting. I remember that when she had students who had difficulty spelling the word cemetery, for example, you know, does it end in E-R-Y or A-R-Y? She would say, think about going through a scary cemetery at night. You go, ee, all the way through, which is completely silly. And she didn't mind making a fool out of herself in front of her students because they remembered what she said. They remembered those tricks. And so I grew up being friends with words, so to speak. And well, another time she asked me what I'd been doing. I was quite young. And I said, well, I've been laying on the couch all afternoon. And she clasped her hands to the side of her face and said, oh, goody, you've been laying on the couch. How many eggs? Now I won't have to go to the store. And so she was very funny, but she also knew her grammar. And so I sort of learned that by osmosis. And then I had a wonderful Latin class when I was in ninth grade and took more Latin in high school that I really loved. Then I got to college and tried Greek, and that was really hard.
Yeah. I want to have you tell that story. It's very, very touching, that this retired professor who helped you with that. I want to tell a story of my own. My dad was an English major, so I got a lot of that, you know. At one point, a relative wrote to say that another relative had prostate cancer.
Oh, dear.
Had problems with his prostate. So for Dad, that was, you know, we felt sorry for the fellow. He was okay in the end. Then we got this lecture on prostate versus prostrate. Mm-hmm. Dad even got on the floor and demonstrated prostrate versus supine versus prone.
Okay.
That's how much Dad loved language. So it is an adventure.
Yeah, and you never forgot that, right?
No.
Because he illustrated it, and he taught you in a way that involved all of your senses.
Yeah. So tell me about this fascinating chapter, touching as well, this charming man that you got to tutor you in Greek.
Well, when I was in college, I thought that Greek would be as easy as Latin, and I found out that it was really, really difficult. There's a reason that people say it's Greek to me, at least in my case. I just found it really difficult. You know, it was different letters and different markings on the page, and I was just really struggling in my introductory Greek class. And so right at the point where I had to make a decision, I decided that rather than flunk the class, I would drop it. But I made a promise to myself that I would go home to Louisville that summer and find some starving graduate student who would tutor me in ancient Greek. What I found instead was this amazing retired professor of classics. He, Dr. Leonard Litkovsky, he was an immigrant from Latvia, and he was a polyglot. He spoke at least a dozen languages quite easily. And he was one of these born teachers who just couldn't stop teaching. And so he agreed to teach me Greek on Monday nights. And he taught different languages to people during the week, you know, Turkish and Hebrew and Russian and Italian. It just depended on the night. And he did all of this for free. He just, you know, I mean, teachers change lives. And he was one of these people who continued to do this again and again. And so I went to visit him the first night, and he just kept the lesson didn't go well at all. You know, I had my book of dreary drills and vocabulary lists and all of that. And he just kept shaking his head and shuffling his feet and saying, language is not arbitrary, is not arbitrary. And I didn't know what he was talking about. And I left that night quite disappointed. But he made really good fresh bread himself with a recipe from the old country, which was great. And he also served wonderful strong coffee. So I thought, well, I'll go back one more time. And I ended up that time he took my book and threw it on the table and said, we won't need this anymore. We're going to read Oedipus Rex, the great tragedy by Sophocles in the original Greek. And I thought the guy was nuts, but he started with the word Oedipus. And he told me that Oedipus means literally in ancient Greek, Oedipus means swollen foot, because if you know the story of Oedipus, as a baby, his feet were damaged and they were always swollen ever after. And he said, "You have in English, do you not, the word edema?" And I said, "Yeah, it means swelling. And he said, "Yes, Oedipus and edema are related, you see. And the pus in Oedipus is related to words like octopus and pedestrian and pedal and all these words in Greek and Latin and Sanskrit." And so he started to teach me Greek from that one name in a totally different way, because he understood that there are so many languages. Nearly half the world's population speaks a language that comes from the original prehistoric root, Proto-Indo-European, an ancient, ancient language. And then they branched out, you know, like the branches of a tree, which means that English is related to languages like Russian and Irish and Italian and Greek and all these different languages that sprang from that same source. So it was sort of like getting a bird's eye view of language and seeing how words and words were connected between and among languages. And it was, to me, it was thrilling, because it meant that you could look at a word and pry it open and see these images and secrets. And I've been doing that ever since. And I ended up studying with the professor for 12 years until he died. And I went back to college. In the meantime, I would see him when I came back in the summer and for the winter holidays, and then when I lived in Louisville again, I studied with him again. But I took every Greek course I could, and went on and did graduate work in ancient Greek, and it really was life changing. It was one of those experiences where, you know, you have a situation and you think, "Oh my gosh, this is a failure. This is terrible. It's never going to get better." And it turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Hmm. His last words to you turned out to be his last words, or no me olvides, right? Don't forget me.
Yes.
Why do you think he went to Spanish for that?
That's a really good question, Tom. Yeah, I went to visit him in the hospital, and we had a wonderful conversation. He had fallen when he was out shopping, and he had been hospitalized, and he seemed okay. You know, we talked about gemstones and this and that etymology, and he had newspapers around his hospital room in lots of different languages, and he seemed in good shape. But as I was leaving his room, he said to me in Spanish, "No me olvides," which, if you know Spanish, you know it means "don't forget me." And I thought that was odd at the time, because everything had seemed to be going so well. And I got a call the next morning that he had died. And I have puzzled over that, Tom, in the intervening years. Why did he reach for a language that I didn't know very well at the time, and, you know, one that he was perfectly comfortable in? But why did he reach for a final goodbye in a language that was at one remove from us both? I you know, maybe it was just sort of, it's a good question. Maybe it was just sort of his way of, I don't know, distancing himself and us from the reality of what was going to happen overnight. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. Going to a language that was, you know, not the language you had shared, right? Which is Greek, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew enough to know what he was saying, but it was at one remove from us both. And I will always wonder what he was thinking.
I want to read from that chapter. Just you say, talking about the professor, "The two of us shared a passion for ancient Greek, the miracle of language, those invisible connections between words, and the thrill of prying open a single word or phrase to make it give up its secrets." So you call these people worders, right? Kind of a takeoff on birders, right? Encountering language and words in the wild, right? What is it about worders, yourself included, right? Myself included, that that fascinates them so, do you think?
Well, yeah, I started bird watching in the last year, and I was struck by the fact that people who do bird watching call themselves birders, and I was thinking, well, you know, I think word nerds like me and like you, we're worders. You know, we love to observe words in the wild and just luxuriate in them for the fascination, you know, whether it's a word that's beautiful or has a really interesting history or a word that's puzzling, you know, one you've never heard before. I love when somebody shows me a new word that I've never heard of before, or a new dialectal term that I've never heard anybody use. There's a delight in knowing that these words kind of have lives of their own, and you know, we take them for granted, and the fact is that with little more than a mouthful of air, I can make you sort of understand what I'm saying. I heard somebody describe it recently as it's as if you have a movie screen in your head and I'm projecting something into your head, and you might not see exactly what I see in my head, but the fact that we can use words to at least approximate what we're saying to each other, approximate what we're thinking, and get somebody else to understand that, I mean, that's truly a miracle.
By the way, just I'll bring this in right now because it popped in my brain. On the show, you develop new words, right, along with your listeners. Mm. One of my favorites that you mentioned is melancholy or sadness that your favorite restaurant is closing. What I think a listener came up with something for that particular phenomenon.
Yeah, often on the show, my co-host Grant Barrett and I ask listeners to come up with a word that fills a hole in the English language, or a lot of times people will call us on the show and say, is there a word for this or that feeling or this or that phenomenon? And one of the things that came up was, shouldn't there be a word for when your favorite restaurant is closing? And somebody wrote in and said, yeah, I call that melancholy, which I just love.
That is good.
Yeah, you need a word for that. I mean, we all know that feeling. And somehow, to me, it helps to have a word like that. Somebody else suggested bon appetit, which
that's a good
also kind of like.
Yes. I didn't know this. So reading your book, this in your introduction. There's a word for the warmth of sun in winter.
Yes, the word apricity.
Apricity, that's a very specific meaning, yeah.
Yeah, and isn't it a pretty word? But, you know, when you step outside and there's snow on the ground, there's a chill in the air, but there's also that warmth of sun. It's a gorgeous word. It's one of those words that was around, I think, in the 17th century and was used a bit then, but then fell out of use. And I think it's one of these words that deserves a comeback.
Yeah. Another one I love, I hadn't even known this, there's a word that means to put off until the day after tomorrow. That's very specific.
Yes, it is. The word is perendinate. It comes from Latin words that mean for the third day. You know, we have the word procrastinate, and that was, you know, speaking about birding, procrastinate was kind of one of my, in birding, you talk about your spark bird, the bird that really sets you on the path of birding because you saw this one extraordinary bird and you just couldn't get enough, and, you know, it becomes addictive. And for me, procrastinate was a bit of a spark word for me because when I was in ninth grade Latin class, I learned that the word for tomorrow is cross, C-R-A-S. And I thought, cross? Does that have anything to do with procrastinate? And so I went running to the dictionary and holy cow, you know, procrastinate comes from Latin words that mean for tomorrow, to put off until tomorrow. And I was quite pleased to learn just a few years ago that perendinate means to put off until the day after tomorrow. I don't know how often you would use that, but it's nice to know it exists, right?
Well, yeah, and now that I know it, I'll be using it. That's it seems like put off till tomorrow. It's better if you're going to put it off, better to put it off till the day after tomorrow, right?
Right, right. Sorry, boss.
We're due for a break, but just before we go to break, I was thinking about you had experience in translation, right? Learning Greek and this whole process of translating, your experience with your beloved professor. And it's interesting that kind of highlights one aspect of language, which is it's very much tied to culture oftentimes. And I'm thinking about one of my favorite words. It's Portuguese, saudade.
Oh,
Um,
saudade.
saudade, which is what, longing, melancholy, nostalgia. But my Brazilian friends tell me, yeah, it's that, but it's a lot of stuff that you, as an English speaker, can't even, you can't approximate it. I guess you have to kind of be Brazilian or Portuguese to understand the full meaning.
Yeah, tudo bem. Saudade has a lot of layers to it that I just don't think we have with words like nostalgia. Although, if you know the Greek roots of nostalgia, it's kind of cool because nostos means return. You read that a lot in the Odyssey, of course, because Odysseus is trying to return to Ithaca. But the cool part about nostalgia to me is the last part of it, which literally means pain. Algia, it's like analgesic, which is something that you take to relieve yourself from pain. Nostalgia is like the pain of wanting to return. But I have Brazilian friends as well who will talk about saudade, meaning just it's I don't really know how to articulate it, but it's got all these layers that I just am not aware of a single English word having.
Yeah, and there are probably English words, similar, similarly maybe opaque to or hard to pick up for non-English speakers, right? I can't think of one right now, but I guess maybe because I'm immersed in English, but.
Well, a lot of idioms, certainly. Do you want to hang out or let's listen up, like why up? We have a lot of words and phrases like that.
Yeah, idioms are fun and frustrating, right? If you're trying to learn a language, because you know the words. For example, in Spanish, many Spanish cultures, you don't have a headache, your hair hurts, right?
Yeah, that's a good one. Your hair hurts, and I'm trying to think of well, I mean, there are just so many English idioms that really don't make sense. I mean, what does it mean to kick the bucket, Yeah, we get we often get calls on Away with Words from speakers of English as a second or third or fourth language, and sometimes they're just mystified by this idiom or that, and it's a great opportunity for us to step back and think, yeah, that is really weird. Why do we say that?
Let's do take a break. We're talking with Martha Barnett. She is a co-host of Away with Words, heard all over the country and on podcast form, I think, as
Yes,
well.
podcast as well. And you can go to our website, waywardradio.org, and listen to hundreds of past
All
episodes.
right, waywardradio.org or com
ORG.
or ORG. Okay. The new book we're talking about is Friends with Words. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest today is Martha Barnett, who spent 2 decades as co-host of Away with Words, lauded by Mary Norris of New Yorker as a virtual treasure house and a car talk for Lexophiles. She's out with a new book called Friends with Words. I want to ask you about that. I guess you take it a badge of honor that you're car talk for Lexophiles?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I mean, I loved Car Talk, and I know so many people do. And the fact is that years ago, the previous producer of Away with Words, Mary Garbisi, when they were first starting this show at KPBS back in 1998, she actually went to Boston to WBUR and shadowed the Car Talk guys for a week to learn how they put the show together. So yes, we have we have a bit of Car Talk DNA in our veins, and I'm perfectly happy to be talking about the show in terms of Car Talk. I don't think I ever learned to fix my car from
Yeah,
Car Talk, but
right.
I sure enjoyed the conversations.
It was much more about the brothers, right?
Yes,
About
and the callers,
their relationship and the callers, yeah. More about life than cars. That's,
exactly.
what your show, I think, language gets us into life, right? So, yeah.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about your journey from, I guess, maybe starting with your mother. She was an English teacher, right? So maybe you started out as a prescriptionist in terms of grammar, and then you've become much more of an observational grammarian. Tell me about that.
Yes, my mother was very much a prescriptivist, which meant that she revered these rules of grammar, many of which are very useful. I mean, you have to understand grammar in order to write well, I think. But there are some rules of grammar that were instituted by 17th and 18th century grammarians who were just kind of these self-appointed language authorities who decided, for example, that you mustn't end a sentence with a preposition. Well, I like to say that's nonsense up with which I will not put, because what these guys were trying to do was prescribe a way of speaking and writing that conformed more with Latin grammar. And you don't end sentences in Latin with prepositions, but it's perfectly normal to do it in English. So that was a rule that I had to discard the more I learned about language. Another one is splitting an infinitive. That was a big no-no when I was growing up, and when William Shatner would talk about to boldly go where no man has gone before, I would bristle, and my mother would actually go to the chalkboard. We had chalkboards back then. Black slate, and she would go to the chalkboard and say, "This is what that sounds like to me." And she would take her fingernails and put them up on the chalkboard and drag them all the way down. And she would say, "That's just painful for me to hear anybody split an infinitive." But the truth is that this was one of these arbitrary rules that these prescriptivists came up with, prescribing how to speak and write. And the fact is that. Again, if you go back to Latin, an infinitive is a single word. There's no way that you can split it. And in fact, in Old English, the infinitives are single words. You can't split them. So it was just a silly, arbitrary rule, again, that people got their knuckles rapped for. And see, I just ended the sentence with a preposition for which people got their knuckles rapped. So I have learned over the years, over the 20 years I've been doing the show now, to relax a little bit and be more of a descriptivist, which is what the vast majority of linguists are now. They just describe language. They're like birders. They're worders who look at language and describe it. And the same is true for dictionaries as well. People have thought that the dictionary tells you how you should speak and write, but the fact is that they're just trying to keep up with us. They're just recording what people say. And if enough people start saying a certain word, then you have to include it in the dictionary. It's a record, a reflection of how we talk.
People will use language how they will, right? It's a living thing, right? So you can't prescribe it. I'm thinking about the French Academy that I don't know if they still try to prescribe their way, frown on Le Skyscraper and the like, but you can't stop it, right? You certainly can't stop language going where it's going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an organic thing. It's an organism. I mean, think about English itself, or the first line of Beowulf, "Hvat ve garden yar dagum theud kuniga thrumjefrunin." I mean, that does not sound like modern English. And English has gone through a process of change and will continue to. I mean, we see that all around us right now, right?
I want to get into talking about how you developed the radio program. Again, Away with Words on many public radio stations on podcast form as well. So I just want to read this. I was terrified of public speaking. If you told me I would someday co-host a public radio show and podcast reaching hundreds of thousands of listeners, speak to hundreds more at a time in shows before a live audience, I would have told you that's preposterous. Then I guess the worder that you are, you go on to talk about the word preposterous. That's where I wanted to have you start. Tell me about the word preposterous before we get into the story.
Okay, preposterous is a great word because, again, it goes back to Latin. And if you break it down, you see pre and post, which come from Latin words that mean before and after. So something that's preposterous is literally backwards. And it's just ridiculous, it's the cart before the horse.
So, you worked, we'll skip a little bit here. You worked for some newspapers, right? And then I guess you, for this part of the story, you end up in San Diego, I think, right?
Yes, I worked for the Louisville Times and the Courier Journal in Kentucky back in the day, and then I was having sort of a push-pull, a love-hate relationship with academia. I kind of wanted to be a Greek professor, but I also really loved journalism. So how was I going to marry the two? And I ended up supporting my etymological habit by doing a lot of freelancing for magazines. And while I was studying ancient Greek at the University of Kentucky, and I was also trying to put kind of a net over the kinds of things that Professor Lutkowski had taught me about language. And I ended up writing one book about the origins of flower names. For example, a gladiolus comes from Latin gladium, which means sword, a relative of gladiator, because it's related to because of the shape of the leaves. That's why the gladiolus is called what it's called. So anyway, I was writing one book about called The Garden of Words about flower names. I did another book about food names, another book about animals that are tucked into the language in places you might not imagine, like the name Melissa in ancient Greek means honeybee, and Deborah means honeybee in Hebrew. So anyway, I had written these books on word origins. And the original hosts of Away with Words, which started in 1998 at KPBS here in San Diego, were Richard Lederer, who was a popular writer of books about English, and Charles Harrington Elster, who was a real authority on pronunciation. And they did the show for a few years, and then Charlie left the show, and they did a nationwide search. Found me in Kentucky writing books about word origins with a passion for language and a huge public speaking phobia. But yeah, they gave me a chance to come out here and try out. And I just thought, let's hope if I leap, the net will appear, because I couldn't imagine anything more fun than talking about this stuff with people who want to talk about it.
Then you went on, obviously you got on with the show and, presumably, well, obviously overcame your fear of public speaking and, but at a certain point, KPBS was having some budget problems, canceled the show or withdrew their support. So what did you guys do then?
Yes, this was a really painful time. This was at the beginning of the recession in 2007, and the show had was just on a two or three stations. It was on throughout Wisconsin for some reason. It was on here in San Diego, and I believe we were on in Indianapolis, and we were just about to add another station. Our ratings had never been higher, but you know, it was the beginning of the recession, and public radio is always working hard to raise those funds, and it was just too much. KPBS had to cancel our show and another local show, which was really heartbreaking at the time. And my co-host Grant and our intrepid producer Stephanie Levine and I just thought, wait a minute, this is too good. The feedback we get from listeners is just so phenomenal. People love this, and there's so much more to say. People love talking about language, and we have an educational mission here, you know, to share this stuff with people. And so we just thought, well, we'll do this ourselves, which was pretty naive actually at the time, because you know, the budget to do the show was over $200,000, and so we made a lot of sacrifices because we had to keep pumping out the show. We couldn't build the show and then put it out. We had to keep producing the show every week, which, as you know, is a lot of work. So we decided we would do it ourselves. And one of the things we decided was to form a nonprofit, because we did have a lot of support from public radio listeners, because, as you know, public radio listeners are endlessly curious, and they love civil conversation that respects their intelligence. And so we formed a nonprofit with some supporters who supported our show, and then we had to figure out how we were going to distribute it. And so we distributed the show for free. It's free of charge. We would love to be on there in Utah if that opportunity ever arises. We make this show available to any public radio station that wants it, totally free. So our listeners, thank goodness, experience no interruption in service, and it looks as if we're being produced by a public radio station or public radio network, but the fact is, it's this little bitty nonprofit right here in San Diego.
Let's take another break, come back with a brief final segment with Martha Barnett. She is co-host of Away with Words. You can find them at waywardradio.org, right? And the new book is Friends with Words. That's out and available now. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with Martha Barnett. She is co-host of Away with Words, heard across the country as a radio program and podcast. You can find them at waywardradio.org. She's out with a new book, Friends with Words. Fascinating book. It's out and available now. So throughout the book, Martha Barnett, you have some regional vocabulary, or some regional, call them trips, I guess, road trips. Of course, I went to the Mountain West and looked up Utah. You highlight "Oh my heck," which is certainly used euphemisms for swear words, right? Religious influence there, but also feel and fill, right? One thing you notice a lot, I notice a lot, is salesmen on the radio talk about a sell. They have a sell. Come on down, because I have a sell. So that particular vowel, you know, transliteration, transformation. You have a story, I guess.
Yeah, there's a great story that involves Utah and what linguists call the fill-feel merger, which is linguists get very, very excited about these vowel mergers where sail sounds like sell, as you suggested, and jail sounds like gel. There's a great story that occurred in Salt Lake City in 2008 at a place called Cafe Trio there, and a would-be robber walked in to the cafe and held out a bag to the cashier there and said, "Feel the bag." And the cashier misunderstood it and reached up and felt the bag because of that vowel merger. And the robber got so flustered that he fled. Actually, I was in Salt Lake City a few years ago to give a speech. Beautiful city, by the way. I'd never been there, and I really loved it. And I went by Cafe Trio and talked to one of the surfers about that story, because it just, it's such a great example of the Phil merger. And I highly recommend their tomato soup if Cafe Trio is still around.
Ah, yes. Yeah, for sure. Also, there's the we're going to eat park and the pork, that kind of thing. Were you barn in the born, that kind of thing?
Right. Were you barn in the born? And I was going to ask you about culinary water. Number one, if that's the way it's pronounced, and if people still say it, because I had never heard this term before, but I gather that's a Utah term. Huh?
Yeah, I never hear potable. That's how the rest of the country says it, I guess. It's culinary. Mm-hmm. It's always culinary.
Culinary, and not culinary, but culinary.
Okay. Culinary usually, yeah. Culinary a little bit, culinary. Including an official, you know, the water authorities will say culinary water, right?
Oh, they will?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I had read that in print, and I had never heard it, so I didn't know how it was pronounced, so I wanted to make sure to ask you.
That's one of those I was unaware that the rest of the country was different. I guess the rest of the country is different from Utah in that respect, yeah. I wanted to, in your chapter on word origins, you say you're often asked what's your favorite word. I guess that would be an obvious question. So what do you, I guess it's whatever word you'd encountered latest, but you do have an answer you give people.
Yeah, I do. I really like the word mellifluous, which describes the sound of a beautiful voice or a lovely melody, something like that. It's a delicious word to say, I think, to roll around on your tongue. But I'm also, of course, looking at the Latin tucked inside that word, because it literally means flowing with honey. And those of you who know Spanish can see the mel being related to miel in Spanish, and the fluous being related to words like fluid and fluent. And so a mellifluous voice, for example, is one that in its most original sense meant flowing with honey. They're all of these wonderful word pictures that are tucked inside of so many words, and that's one of the things that we love on Away with Words is teasing those out.
I want to read from that chapter. I'll just read this. Mellifluous is a great example of what Ralph Waldo Emerson meant when he said, "The etymologist finds the deadest word to have once been a brilliant picture, language's fossil poetry." Then you go on to say, Thomas Carlyle said, "The coldest word was once a glowing new metaphor." That's beautiful. Thank you. Even a word that's kind of has lost part of its meaning over time, or if you go back and look at the origins, it glows anew.
Yes. Yes, those are both wonderful quotations. I love that. And the book actually has an epigraph on the first page, if I can remember it. "Words may be made to disgorge the past, as coal and wine, when we kindle or drink them, yield up their bottled sunshine." I mean, what could be more beautiful? I mean, I talk about how delicious it is to have all these feelings tucked inside a single word, like saudade, for example. But also just, I mean, there's that feeling you get when somebody puts into words something that you've felt, but never been quite able to articulate. So I think those are three great quotations about language.
We'll just have about a minute left. I want to ask you, what do you hope people, you know, very short answer, what do you hope people get from the book and the radio show?
Well, two things. Certainly the joy of language, which we've been talking about for this hour. There's a lot about language in the book. The book is also loaded with memoir, and I think that the takeaway from that is that the end of the story is never the end of the story. You know, I had that failure of studying ancient Greek, and it turned out to, and that failure turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. I had a terrible fear of public speaking, and obviously I can do it now. And so those are a couple of the lessons that I hope come across in the book. You know, that there's always another chapter. And I guess for the radio show, I would just invite people to call the show. Or email us at wordswaywardradio.org and call us with your questions, email us with your questions. We'd love to continue talking about language. There's just still so much to say, even after 20 years.
Well, we've been talking with Martha Barnett, who you can find at marthabarnett.com. And waywardradio.com is a place to find the show. And Friends
.org,
with Words,
yeah.
.org, thank you.
Yeah.
And Friends with Words is the new book that's out and available now and fascinating, as we've been, hope you got the sense of that from our conversation here. Martha Barnett, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Being outside here on the back up on the back porch here in the shade and a little breeze with the trumpet vine with the orange flowers and some bees and some sparrows and red-breasted house finches hanging around. Where it's one sky, many cultures, Skywatcher Leo T here as we look into early fast-moving August skies with the earth spinning faster, the days are getting shorter, and not because summer is waning in the northern hemisphere. On Tuesday, August 5th, Earth's solar day was ever slightly shorter than the usual 24 hours. This according to timeanddate.com, making it not only one of the shortest days of 2025, but also since records began. At just 1.25 milliseconds shorter, it won't be noticeable, but it's part of a puzzling trend that's baffling scientists. Earth is spinning faster after decades of slowing down, or planet's rotation has been speeding up in recent years, and timekeepers have no definitive explanation. And in the smoky skies, you can still find dark or at least darker skies. The Perseid meteors will probably produce a few fireballs of color and light this week, according to NASA. While they are already shooting across the night sky, the most well-known meteor shower is about to reach its peak on the 12th and 13th. Excuse the chainsaw across the street here. On the 12th and 13th, with a chance of fireballs and 20 to 75, depending on your sky conditions. Good luck with that. Find a black backdrop of night. By the way, the Perseids come from comet Swift Tuttle. Also in the night sky, the waxing gibbous moon of August rides low in the south, crossing Scorpius and Sagittarius, touring those great nebula and sky formations. And early in the morning, brilliant Venus rises above the east-northeast horizon about an hour before the first sign of dawn, followed by Jupiter, the largest but second brightest planet. On the 9th, Jupiter follows only by about 10 minutes behind Venus. During this time, their separation shrinks as they draw closer every day toward a spectacular meeting or conjunction in early dawn of August 12th, a little game of cosmic pool. Hey, nice shot. With Jupiter to Venus's upper left or north. And still on the boards, the follow-up to Apollo, the Artemis program, remember that? Going to the moon and all that? See the photo of NASA's Artemis crew on the Skywatcher Facebook page as they train to go. The first crew slated to fly in NASA's Orion spacecraft during the Artemis II mission around the moon early next year entered their spacecraft for a multi-day training at the agency's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. NASA astronaut Reid Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Cook, and CSA or Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen participated in a suited crew test and crew equipment interface test, performing launch day and simulated orbital activities inside Orion. Every milestone in the Artemis campaign brings us closer to landing Americans back on the moon and pushing on toward Mars, acting NASA Administrator Sean Duffy said. Look on the Skywatcher Facebook page for a photo snapped by the JPL NASA Curiosity Mars rover. Now, that's not the Perseverance. This one has been up here for several years, the Curiosity has, doing some groundbreaking work. And that photo used the remote micro imager to view this wind-eroded rock, which is obviously coral, on July 24th of 2025. Curiosity has found many rocks like this one, which were formed by ancient water combined with billions of years of sandblasting by the wind. Water carried dissolved minerals into rock cracks and later dried, leaving the hardened minerals behind. Eons of sandblasting by the wind wore away the surrounding rock, producing this unique shape seen today. And speaking of water, this just in, a giant wave in the Pacific Ocean was the most extreme rogue wave ever recorded. Well, you know, recording has only gone on since it's gone on. This is from Nature magazine by Carly Casella in August of 2025. And in November 2020, a freak wave appeared, lifting a lone buoy off the coast of British Columbia 58 feet high. A few years later, the four-story wall of water was confirmed to be the most extreme rogue wave ever recorded. Such an extreme event is thought to happen only once every 1,300 years. And if the buoy hadn't been taken for a ride, we might not have ever known it occurred. As it is one sky, many cultures, stars hold the sky together. And the stars on our rock ceilings hold the rocks together. That's according to Navajo builders of their star ceilings. There are some 50 of these masterpieces spread across the canyons of northwestern New Mexico and northeastern Arizona, positioned on rock overhangs and deep alcoves, planetarium sites, the archaeologists call them. The stars are straight edge crosses or petal leaf forms, colored orange, red, dark gray, blue, and black. They were probably applied by some sort of stamping technique employing leather or cut yucca leaves, mounted on long wooden poles and dipped in paint. See Anthony Aveni's fabulous star stories for more. And keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space and time, and ride that chainsaw into space. Skywatcher Leo T.